We're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 22, verses 1 to 14. But this passage is called if ever you're listening to Jewish people, at times you might hear them refer to the Akedah. That means the binding. That's what they call this passage, the binding of Isaac. And so it's a very well-known passage to the Jewish people. And it's a passage that we know. If you know many Old Testament stories, this is one of them. And begins and says, "Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, Here I am. And then he said, Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And he split the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abram lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey, and the lad will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you." Well, we always like to start, if you're in a narrative, figuring out who. What kind of whos do you see? God. Abraham.
Son Isaac.
Young men. Two young men. Yeah, if we want to be egalitarian, we can include the donkey. Okay. I think that about covers it. Okay, good. I don't think I included the donkey. Okay. So those are some of the characters. It's a small group. Anyone missing that you might have thought could be in the passage? And where's Sarah in all this? Did Abraham tell her, "Honey, I'm going to be taking Isaac to sacrifice him"? You know, there's a lot that we're not told. It's kind of compared to drawing a veil over the scene. And one of the things is, did Sarah ever know until after the fact?
It's also interesting he called Isaac your only son.
Calls him your only son, okay? And why is that interesting?
Because he has another.
Well, there's Ishmael out there. But I guess what he's emphasizing here, the son who is the heir. In other words, so yes, there is that other son, but this is the son of the inheritance. There is no plan B. So in that sense, but he's putting the knife between the ribs, as sometimes we say. Your son, your only son. The one you love. I mean, did he need to tell him those things? Oh, that Isaac. I forgot. Okay. He's really hammered that home.
This is hard enough. I wouldn't want to tell Randy that God told me to go do this.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard enough that I know that God said this. I'm putting myself in that place. But then I want to listen to him try to talk me out of it. Is that enough?
Seems like he doesn't tell anyone, not even Isaac, until the last moments.
Yeah.
Where'd they go? So again, we like to who, where. He said, "Now take your son, your only son, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." Over in 2 Chronicles 3, we're told, Solomon began to build the whole house of the Lord at Jerusalem, on Mount Moriah. Okay.
And is he going from Beersheba to the Indian Freeze Lake?
Yes. Last we saw him in the region of Beersheba. And so that's what I would take. Here's our map. And so again, you look at, this is the Negev, which are the south in some of your translations. Beersheba here. The Well of Oath, or the Well of Seven. Hebron, where Mamre, the Oaks of Mamre are. Okay. Down here, Dead Sea. Off there, the Gerar is here. There's the Gaza Strip, Mediterranean. So again, Bethlehem, Jerusalem. So he's going from Beersheba to Jerusalem. And you can see, just a little north of Jerusalem, you'll see Bethel. These are some of the sites that we've been seeing. So if we put them into the map, there's Abraham, Isaac. We would probably put his age somewhere as an upper teen-ish. 17, 18, some said 20 years old. So he might be a little young looking, or that's a really big donkey or something he's by there. And the two young men with him, if you can kind of see them. So they start off from Beersheba and they travel up to Jerusalem together. We're told it takes 3 days, or maybe he arrived on the third day. It's about a 45-mile trip. And if you notice, there's a highway along the way, or a road. So it's not just, you know, going through brambles and forests. So but it took him about 3 days to get there. Traditionally, it's understood that what's that talking? Notice we said that Solomon built the temple on Mount Moriah, and he was said to Moriah, one of the mountains, I will show you. And so it's usually generally assumed that would have been the Temple Mount, is Mount Moriah. There are two Islamic structures or mosques, if you will, on the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount was where Solomon built his temple. That was destroyed by the Babylonians, rebuilt under the time of Zerubbabel, a very modest rebuilding of the temple. When Herod comes along, he vastly upgrades it. And so in the days of Jesus, it was a magnificent structure. That's destroyed by the Romans in AD 70. As in fact, it's on the same day in the Jewish calendar, the ninth of the month of Av, Tisha B'Av. And so that's today a day of fasting and mourning among the Jewish people. And they recognize, as God must be telling us something, twice he's destroyed the temple on the very same day. But this is, so after that all was destroyed, along comes this Muslim structure. So you want to give me a guesstimate when this was built? If the temple was destroyed in AD 70, when's the Muslim structure built?
After 600,
right. So Muhammad's born 570. 620, 21 is when Islam technically starts with the Hijra from Mecca to Medina. But that kind of starts Islam. Muhammad dies not too much after that. And after his death, Islam really dramatically spread. It spread during his time. So we could say in the 7th century, in the 600s, this structure was built on the Temple Mount. And there it has remained ever since. So this is called the Dome of the Rock. And so you can see it's carefully decorated. Here's the looking up into the Dome of the Rock. And does anyone know what is in the Dome of the Rock?
Rock.
A rock. That's very important. Yes. There's the rock. Looking down at it from above. And here's another look. So this is a place of prayer, but this is the rock. In Islamic tradition, in a night dream, Muhammad had a vision in which he came to Jerusalem, and on a stallion from this spot, he launched off into heaven and visited heaven. In Jewish understanding, this is the rock on the mount. This is the spot on which Isaac was offered. Also, it is considered archaeologically probably the best understanding. This is basically where the Holy of Holies was. And some will even point to this kind of square cutting here as perhaps where the ark itself sat. So this place is very sacred to the Jewish people. It's very sacred. It's considered by many to be the third most sacred site in Islam, but it is supremely. This is the place of the Holy of Holies. This is the place of the temple. So this place is sacred to the Jews, and so that's why there's, you know, conflict continually over. And just recently, just this year, there've been battles, bombs thrown, structures torn up, and conflict over this area of the Temple Mount. But that's the Dome of the Rock, and so this is, tradition says this is the spot where Isaac was offered. Yes?
Do they worship here, or are they just protecting the rock?
The Muslims?
Yes.
They will come in and pray in there.
So around the edges?
Yes.
And we're forbidden, so these are just like some Muslim took these pictures and you got them off the internet? Or Gentiles forbidden?
I think you can go in here. I have been into both those mosques. You do have to take your shoes off. You have to be dressed, especially women, well, guys too, but you have to be dressed modestly. I think there's a fee or something. I think you can still go in here. Last time I was there, they didn't go in, but yes, you can go in there and be in that place. It's really amazing to me to walk around the Temple Mount and think about the temple being there and seeing some of the evidences of that. You do have to be very careful. You're not allowed to read a Bible verse. You're not allowed to have a Bible with you. You're not allowed to have Christian or Jewish religious literature. And so, like, if you're ever with a tour guide up there, they'll often, you know, kind of quietly, it's all secretively. This is right here. Look at your feet. Okay, I brought you over. If you notice this right here, this shows you the evidence of this kind of building. And then a Muslim guard will come by and they say, and so, yes, this is where Muhammad, they're very cautious about that. I mean, you go in and they go through your books. If people have been, whole groups have been kicked off because someone forgot and brought along their songbook or something. They're very adamant there is to be no prayers offered of a Jewish or Christian nature. A lot of Jews are saying, it is our Temple Mount. And so that's the kind of conflict that goes on. But yes, I think you can still go in there. So anyway, that's the temple. That's the, I would say, this is where it happened. If not, it's in some other area like it, right in that area. One of the other areas, and this is the most, but this is the most likely spot. So he says, go to the mountain, I'll show you. And I'll just in passing say, I didn't look at like the King James. It might have some statement like get you or that I mentioned when we were back in Romans. You got to watch me. Genesis 12. There was this Hebrew expression, lech lecha. It's you personally go. It's an emphatic command to an individual. You get you going. You might translate it. That expression is only used in two places. The call of Abraham in Genesis 12, and here, you go to a mount I'm going to show you, just like before, to a land I'm going to show you. And so, you know, I think we're supposed to remember that the covenant and the promises and God's gracious dealings.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
That picture?
Yes.
Is the top of the page, is that east? Where the light is that the same? I mean, is that east? Do they let the light come in the east also?
I would say that might be south. If I'm orienting it right.
When you said east, that the ark was there, that's why I was curious. If the ark was there, that's what made my mind start asking the question.
Yeah. No, this I think this is the eastern, this way.
That
way.
Okay. Just curious. All right.
But I'll just leave that as I think. That's correct.
Okay.
So, we're told Abraham rose early in the morning. You ever told to do something you don't want to do? And do you find that there's 12 reasons you shouldn't do it? You know, I need to reorganize the eggs in the refrigerator just to make sure they're... Don't get cracked while I'm going. You know, any reason not to go. But one of the evidences of obedience is it's immediate and complete. And so that reminds me of something we talked about before when we were in Proverbs. What Mark Twain said. If you eat a live frog every morning, he says, eat a live frog every morning and nothing worse will happen to you the rest of the day. So I think there's a lot of truth in that. And so the point is, you know, sometimes diligence says, I'm going to do the task I least want to do, and then the rest of the day will be easy. Instead of putting off, that's a phone call I don't want to make. It's like, I'm going to make that phone call, and then the rest of the day is, if you will, uphill from there or downhill, however you want to describe it. So So that was Abraham's philosophy. And here's a young Sunday school student who's learned a lesson. And so he's going to eat that frog and launch off into the day. So when you see that, I want you to think of Abraham. Have I just ruined?
Same thing you did sending Hagar out.
Yeah.
Got up early.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and did he want to? Remember, he was the one that went, this is Ishmael. I love Ishmael. That's a sign of obedience. You know, so often it's, well, when God makes me desire to do it, no. If it's in God's word, sometimes I don't want to do it, but do the right thing. Take the step of obedience. And so that's a challenge for us. First thing, he got right on it. So as you read this passage, Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. And then on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, the lad, and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you." And so Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. As you read that passage, does anything strike you? Dennis.
What stands out to me is that Abraham says that the two young men stay there and we will return, knowing what he's about to do.
We will return. Well, and who's leaving?
Abraham and Isaac.
So it's not like that means that if it's going to be we, two are leaving, so two have to return. Yeah.
Is it reading too much into it to say he laid the wood on Isaac and he carried it just like Christ carried the cross?
Many people see a picture of that. And so, here is, carrying the wood on his own shoulders as our Lord did to his place of suffering. One commentator summarized the text by saying, Abraham loved God so much he gave his only begotten son. There's a parallel in that sense here. But yes, he loaded him up. What's interesting to me is, to me it just seems like it's so thorough in the details. You know, how often, like when it said that he went out from the promise, from Ur of the Chaldees and Haran to the Promised Land, did it talk about how he packed and brought along the foot? It seems like it's just this really slow detail. And so we have to step back for a minute and say, who is the original audience? The Jews coming out of Egypt. Do they know how this story ends? Think about it. They're the descendants of Jacob, who's a descendant of Isaac.
Yeah, so they know he had to be saved.
Yeah, so they know the story. They know. And so I think what he's doing, he's slowing it down, maybe so we can just get the feel of it. Can't you just say, Abraham, first thing in the morning, he ate the frog and he got going. But every step was painful, I think. And I think it's slowing down just to build. We know how it's going to end, but just to build and help us appreciate what a momentous occasion this was, and what a burdensome act of obedience. Obedience is not, do what you most feel like doing. Obedience is doing what God says. And so he's doing it. But you just get the every step of it is just, I think it's slowed down so we kind of feel. But do you notice we're not told one thing about what Abraham says to Isaac at this point? We're only given them, this. And why? For 3 days, did he not talk? I might have been kind of quiet the whole time. What do you say? For 3 days, is he just trying to remember all the good times they've had? Remember when you joined the softball league? Oh, wait a minute. We don't have softball. did they talk through? But again, Scripture draws a veil of silence. I think one of the things we're being reminded here is obedience is not about our feelings. Faith is not about our feelings. It's about doing what's right.
Wasn't until the third day that he lifted his eyes, you can kind of picture him walking.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he didn't
want to
see that place yet.
No, he can't. This is one, you know, sometimes you can't wait to get there. This is one journey he did not want to end.
I just was thinking that Abraham knew the Lord so well, and that maybe he was taking those 3 days' time to talk to Isaac about God and his attributes and how he could be trusted and to instill faith in the boy for what was coming next.
That would be a natural thing, maybe, to make sure he's instructing in the final catechizing, instructing, encouraging, exhorting, maybe. But we're not told, are we? But that would be a natural thing to possibly do. One of the things that's fascinating to me is just sometimes just to study what are people's last words. And here, it's all, you know, we're, again, the last words here are very, very simple. And again, there's a sacred silence brought over it. So here's the questions I was asking. Did anything strike you? That's what that slowness strikes me here. Some similarities to the crucifixion of Christ.
Drake, why do you think he said we will come back to you?
I think that's meaningful. I think it's meaningful.
In what way?
I'll show you. So these are some of the questions we've asked. Well, let me just make one other comment in passing. Notice, he took the fire in his hand. If you're told, I want you to go camping and you're going to build a fire, what do you do to prepare for that? You can pick up a lighter, preferably with the little long end there, and stand back and, you know, and do that kind of thing. Now, if you're from some parts, you know, you might take a couple of gallons of water and stand back, or gallons of gas. But most of the time in the ancient world, if they didn't start the fire, they carried it with them. Fire starting, we're so used to the lighter or the match or whatever it may be. That was not an easy process for them. And so what they would typically do is carry fire. And that might be just keeping some hot embers in a container. But so he brought the fire with him. So that's what that means. That was the typical way they did that. And sometimes they would, when it was something sacred, they would take embers from a sacred fire and bring it with them. So he brought the fire with him. And he says, we will return. Before we get to that other question, why did the Lord ask for him to sacrifice Isaac? Pardon me? It's a test, okay? He wanted to test him. So you almost wanted to hear, you know, this is a test. You know, you ever get that? Remember those? You know, have you got those? So some of you might not remember such things, but,
so I thought I'd play kind of a standard test. I guess we still get them on the radios, don't we?
Mm-hmm. So here's kind of a standard test you might hear.
This is a test of the emergency broadcast system. In the case of a national emergency, it would have sounded something more like this.
So, how do we know it's a test? It said so. What is the text say? Like, we don't know what he said to Isaac, but we know it said it's a test. Now, someone read that where it says it's a test. It came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. Did he tell Abraham, this is a test? No. When he says it's a test, that, you notice, like, frankly, I thought of these radio and TV tests. The whole point is, this isn't the real thing. It's a test. And so we are told this isn't, he is not wanting, from the very beginning, God doesn't want a sacrifice of Isaac. What this is about is not a sacrifice of Isaac. It's about a test of Abraham's heart. And so it's a test of where his heart is. And so I think, too, that's where he keeps emphasizing your son, your only son, the one you love. Will you offer him?
Okay. It's a pagan idea to sacrifice a person.
So again, in the culture, they did that. And so in that sense, yes, but you know, if you read the rest of the scriptures, there, you know, the child sacrifice is abhorrent to God. It's not like he changes his mind. It's more he's testing Isaac, or testing Abraham, and his faith in the matter.
I'm surprised Abraham wouldn't challenge, was this from God or not, because this is so contrary to God's nature.
So the question is, maybe he should have doubted it was even God himself speaking. I think there, as a prophet, he knew. But some have said, well, wait a minute. He would argue about Sodom. Argue may not be. Explore the possibilities, right? Why isn't there any discussion about Isaac? He doesn't try to reason, explore, question. Yes.
So God is omniscient.
Yes.
He knew what was in Abraham's heart.
Yes.
So was it test for Abraham's sake? Or was it to find out what was in his heart or not?
Who is the beneficiary of the test? Does God not know? I hope we all understand. Paul starts off by saying, God knows what's in his heart, right? So why the test? Partly the test is, I think it's for Abraham. It's in the test you actually gain benefit. A lot of teachers will say, you know, the test is an educational experience. You know, some teachers, it's a very important part of their education. The things they forget to mention during the semester, they can cover that on the exam. but a test is, you know, it's for Abraham. It's stretching him in that sense. It's making, but I think also, this is especially being recorded for future generations. It's recording for us. It's displaying his faith. But it's not because God needs to figure out if he believes, if he trusts him, where his heart is. He's making a display for the benefit of Abraham and his descendants. But that's a good question, Jim.
I'm intrigued by your question. You know, what would the Exodus generation of the first readers have made of this? I wonder if they connected it with that offering that you were required to give for your firstborn. And you know, doesn't God say, the firstborn is mine? Mm. You know, I wonder if that was a reminder to them. And this is not a new idea. Firstborn belongs to me.
They were the law. They were, after the Passover, God spared the firstborn of Israel. But he said, because of that, they belong to me.
Right.
And so the Levites became God's substitute. They'll be your substitute, your stand-in. And you have to pay a redemption fee for the firstborn. Because they belong to you. So you're right. Here's the child, yes.
I'm reminded on a very personal level. We had a female sheep that it rejected the male, the little boy. So I'm bottle feeding this baby, and yes, everywhere that Kim went, the lamb was sure to go. And there is, that is the sweetest little lamb. Now, I'm not going to think sweet when I, if I had to sacrifice him as a big ram. It's like, oh, you know, that's just Hansel. Let's just eat him. But this little baby that's following me everywhere as I'm pointing around my little duties, I mean, they didn't have puppies. I mean, if God asked them to sacrifice a puppy, all that cute little puppy. But this baby is so cute, and I've been thinking, that is very personal to the animal live with you for how many days? They were to bring it in and let it stay with them for so long.
Four days.
Yeah. And that baby gets attached to that family. It no longer has its mama. So it's following all the little kids. It's such a big picture. And then I have to kill that baby.
And that's a lamb.
It's a lamb, yeah, but it's still.
But
now the men might not think anything. They're out with those sheep all day long. You know, they don't care. Or they were actually working for the Egyptians. So, you know, but when that little sheep came in, it was taken in as a piece of the family, you know, part of the family, kind of fed from the table.
But I think, so these are some of the things they are thinking. They're thinking about that whole the sacrificial system. They're thinking of the Passover and first child redemption.
And I think they could really connect.
Yeah.
It made them connect.
And so that whole concept of God providing and God substituting, they know how the story is going to end because, you know, he's their great-great-great-granddad. You know, he's got to get through this thing. And so, but they're thinking through the symbolism and the lessons of faith.
Abraham knew that the land of blessing went through Isaac. Therefore, he knew that God would raise Isaac from the dead. So,
or he assumed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he knew he had to in order for Isaac to be responsible for the land through which all the nations will be blessed. So, as far as Abraham was concerned, there was the test. And he knew he wasn't going to kill him. We're just going to go through the motions. He might stick a knife into him and his heart might stop. But in the way this is worded, the way we're interpreting it, he was going to be raised from the dead in a matter of minutes. He'd come right back. You know, I always thought that Abraham's faith was such that he didn't know when, but eventually Isaac would be raised from the dead. But the reason I asked this question, why did he say he would be right back? It sounded like going to go up there and I'm going to stick a knife in him and he's going to jump up and we'll be right back. So where is the test?
Well, let's look at that. And that's where I have that cross-reference passage where in Hebrews we're told Abraham, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And so notice Hebrews emphasizes the test aspect. His response was he offered up and received the promises offered up in his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. So concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. So he's as good as dead in terms of in his own heart. But he believed, well, since he so clearly believed the promise of God, he says, if God wants me to kill him, God's going to bring him back to life because God said, in this child, not in Ishmael, not in the servant that was in our home, but in this child, I'm going to give you the multitude of descendants. I'm going to make you a nation. He is the heir of promise. And so at this point, Abraham is of such faith and strong faith, he says, I'll obey because I know you've got to bring him back to life. Now, it still makes his task hard. But Hebrews gives us the clue to the test is, can he believe God like that? Now, you know, it sounds like it could be, oh, well, of course he knew that, so no big deal. But he's failed this test twice before. When God said, you're going to have descendants, yet he put his wife at risk in Egypt. If he understood what the Bible says about marriage, and he's told, a man's told he's going to have descendants, and he's thinking biblically, he's thinking, my wife, and he's not going to put her at risk. He's going to say, God said, I'm going to have children. That means the two of us are going to survive and be married. The second time when he was in Gerar, it has been specifically now promised in Sarah, in a year, she's going to have a child. If he really believed that, would he really put her at risk? Or just say, speak the truth, God's going to take care of her. He promised. He failed those two tests. So he's tested here, and he passes with flying colors. And in there, too, are those key and vital statements of promise. And so that's, I think, what he's getting at when he says, we will come back to you. He wasn't being deceitful. He believed it because he believed the promise. One of my thoughts is, I didn't want to bring it up too early, back when we were back in the earlier chapters in Egypt and in Gerar. But this is the faith he should have had then, and not put his wife at risk, because that was the promise then. And yet he dropped the ball twice. So now he's finally getting it. And many a wife is nodding her head and said, lucky Sarah, it only took three times. but you see the lesson of faith there, believing God's promise. Well, you know how the narrative will go on, and we'll go with that further on Sunday, but when Isaac, a couple things to notice. When they're going, Isaac says, okay, hey, Dad, here's the wood, here's the fire, there's the knife, where's the lamb? Now, one thing I want to notice, it was such a common experience for him to worship with his father. He knew what was involved. He knew what was involved in worship because it was a part of his life. It was a part of his fiber. He knew what was involved. And that, what a challenge to us, that we should be so consistent that if we don't, something's missing here. Dad, what's going on here? And then his statement, the Lord will provide. Literally, you could translate that, the Lord will see to it. And I'll mention, I'm hoping on Sunday. I always have to say I hope, because who knows what's going to come out of my mouth on Sunday. But the word provide, look at the last half, looks like video, doesn't it? Video is the visual thing. Pro is the word before. To see before. God will see to it. And so then they go up, and God provides the lamb. And so they name the place, they worship him as the God, or as the Lord who provides. Jehovah Jireh, we often say, or Yahweh Yireh. He will see to it. And so there's a lesson to, again, back to the original audience. The aspects of worship, the preciousness of the promises, the certainty of the promises. The model of Abraham like that. And so God's promised us the land. Don't know how it's going to work out. Might be hard getting there, but the land's going to be ours. God's promised. He keeps his covenants. And then there's that very vital lesson for them to remember. God will see to it. He'll provide. We can trust him. If God makes a promise, he'll see to it. He'll provide. Yeah.
I think it's real easy to read this and kind of play Monday morning quarterback and think and kind of put the emotion of what he was probably going through and the thoughts that he was having and not really seeing that or sensing it, you know, reading and seeing what the result was. You know, when he's going through that at the time and he says, you know, we'll be back. Probably hoping that that's what's going to happen. When you're going through something like that, you can't really know exactly what the person's thinking or feeling.
Yeah.
When we read it and we know what happened, but when you're actually going through it.
Hindsight's always perfect, isn't
yeah.
it? Even hindsight gets a little fuzzy, but that's why I want to emphasize the people reading this when it was first written by Moses, they know the story. You know, but he writes the story as if this is the first time. This slow build up. I think just to help them. Sometimes when we're racing through a familiar text, we need to slow down and savor it to see the full effect. And it's not to say that the emotions aren't important, but I think he noticed he doesn't dwell on that, because that's not what drives our obedience. What drives our obedience is our trust in God's promises. And that will be one of those conversations we've probably got to have. Poor Abraham. Every, you know, be generations in heaven. Okay, so here's what I was thinking, you know, walking through that whole process. This, what were you thinking? How would you deal with that? I probably won't use it, but I read R.C. Sproul has used this on a number of occasions, I think, but when he thinks about this passage, he thinks about a couple of dogs he had. And one dog in particular, he just loved this dog. And it was attacked by a snake, and it was just, it survived, but it just really paid a price. And so he had to take this horribly disfigured face every day for, I don't know, weeks, months, and apply salve to it and all this kind of stuff. He bonded to that dog so incredibly. And then he came to the place where the dog, the long-term effects of the toxins caught up, and the dog needed to be put down. He thought, well, I don't need to pay a vet. I've got a rifle. I'm going to... And he thought, I can't do this. And as a matter of fact, he couldn't even take the dog to the vet. He just... He just couldn't even think about it. And so his wife, I guess, or somebody, some students of his, came sometime when he was out of the home and just took the dog to the vet. And when he came home, he heard that the dog was gone, and he wept. And he said, and that was for a dog. That was for a dog. Can you imagine what Abraham was going through on this three-day journey? And so I think we can sit, we can contemplate that. But I think one of the lessons is we don't act. Obedience is not about emotion and feeling. It's about doing what's right, in spite of how you feel. And he passed the test. Two times he faced a test, and fear eclipsed his faith. There's no question he loved Isaac. He treasured him. But he trusted the Lord, and he passed the test. So keep looking at this passage. Get some goodies out of it. Come ready to savor it on Sunday.
And this is a test God would never ask of us today. And we've heard several people use that as God told them to kill their children.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's a good reminder to me. I need to pull out those passages where God specifically is abhorrent toward the idea of that sort of thing. Yeah, that's the whole point. This is exactly, God is not like this. He never once really wanted that. It was only a test. Good point. This is never
from the great counterfeiter.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly right.